And for a lot of us, there's often that one thing that we can focus on that can really transform your lives. And the video I always used to show was called How Wolves Change Rivers. And it's a video of how they reintroduced wolves into the Yellowstone National Park. And what happened over time is that the animals started staying away from the open plains because the wolves would hunt them. The open plains began to regenerate. As it regenerated, the banks of the river started to come back. Beavers started to come back, birds started to come back, and the entire ecosystem changed. And eventually the course of the rivers changed. And the wolves are what we call a keystone species. So if you remove the wolves, it transforms the entire ecosystem. If you introduce wolves, it transforms the entire ecosystem. Beavers are similar to that. Bees are similar to that. So bees and beavers are keystone species.
Yeah.
What are the keystone actions that we need to take and really focus on that take us from where we are to where we want to be?
Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Chike Farrell, and I am really excited today. We're having a little bit of a crossover type event today where we are recording for Uptick, which tends to feature Caribbean innovators live and dig into their stories. We're also recording for a new podcast that's getting started called Sustainability in the Global South, where we also explore themes related to, you know, becoming more sustainable, building more sustainable organizations. So today I'm excited to have Keita Deming. It's great to connect with you again in this environment. We've been able to connect offline as well and have some good conversation.
And online.
And we have a ridiculous number of
similarities,
which I'm sure we will get into a couple. But welcome. It's good to be able to do this in person.
Good to be here.
Well, you know, one of the things that's always so interesting for me in these conversations is to dig into the origin stories a little bit, right? You know, one of the things that we have in common is spending a lot of time in Canada. I was there for undergrad. You studied in Canada, but I've also lived there for much longer. So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, some of your journey and your path. But why don't we maybe to switch it up a little bit, let's start with what you're doing now, because you've done some really interesting things, launched a book, you're doing some really interesting things in the consulting world. So let's start with that, and then we'll go back in time.
Yeah. So right now, I'm really focused on getting entrepreneurs to start playing the long game. So what I found in the work we do, we usually work with entrepreneurs, and usually coming to us to drive revenue and measurable results. So what we realized we were very good at is helping them close the gap between strategy and action, which is the name of my book, Strategy to Action. And we got good at that because we'd come up with a framework that helped them do that, because we, number one thing we believed in and our research showed us was that the single biggest differentiator between high performers and average producers is the time frame or time span which they think, plan, and act. And most of the people we were working with, often when they came to us, our number one job was to raise the level of their gaze.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the work that we're doing right now is helping companies of various sizes and in various situations really look at how do we make sure that the strategy that we have is being executed in a way that helps us win in the market. And then we end up doing a lot of business development work, teaching people how to have conversations that lead to action.
Yeah, I love that. And so you're doing this within the Covenant Group, right? So, so tell us a little bit about Covenant Group, and you know, there's all interesting pieces of it, but tell us a little bit about that.
So the Covenant Group is 25 years old, started by Norm Trainer, and he started in the financial services world. He was a very successful insurance advisor, salesperson at that time, and realized that his real passion was around training and development and coaching. And he started the Covenant, and he called it the Covenant because the Covenant means the promise. So the promise that we keep when we meet our clients, we promise whatever it is that we agree on. We don't do contracts, we do covenants, because it's rooted in law ours is rooted in an ethical principle that we will deliver on what we say we're going to deliver on. So that's why it's called a covenant group. And the tagline for the covenant group is redefining performance. So we've always been focused on performance in some way, shape, or form. And in our world, we look at three levels in everything we do. We start with mindset. We then go to training, coaching, and action.
Okay.
So the common denominator in everything we do is action, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the action you're taking as a result of this? And it's actually surprising the number of ways in which mindset plays into it and then eventually redefines the action that people are taking on an everyday basis. So I'll give you an example. I have many clients who are, I shouldn't say many, but I have a handful of clients who are in AA of some kind.
Okay.
And when I listen to their stories, the one action of not drinking anymore absolutely transformed their lives.
Huh. Okay. Right?
And for a lot of us, there's often that one thing that we can focus on that can really transform your life. So I'll give you, it's a long way of telling the story, but I used to teach kids sustainability stuff.
Yeah.
And the video I always used to show was called How Wolves Change Rivers. And it's a video of how they reintroduced wolves into the Yellowstone National Park. And what happened over time is that the animals started staying away from the open plains because the wolves would hunt them. The open plains began to regenerate. As it regenerated, the banks of the river started to come back. Beavers started to come back. Birds started to come back. And the entire ecosystem changed. And eventually, the course of the rivers changed, all by introducing a pack
this,
of like...
This one thing.
One
okay.
Book of wolves. And the wolves are what we call a keystone species. So if you remove the wolves, it transformed the entire ecosystem. If you introduce wolves, it transforms the entire ecosystem. Beavers are similar to that. Bees are similar to that. So bees and beavers are keystone species.
Yeah.
What we do a lot of times in our work is, because we start with an assessment, is we're trying to find out what's the keystone action in your company that will transform the ecosystem of the company. And we really like to work on those kind of big levers. So that's kind of currently what we're doing. Yeah. A lot of work around closing that gap between strategy and action and helping company find those, what are the keystone actions that we need to take and really focus on that take us from where we are to where we want to be.
I love that. I mean, you know, it's always been, I guess, a feature of my own entrepreneurial journey. You know, I always remember that the stories that fascinated me and scared the crap out of me in school were the stories of the companies that could have seen this big change coming and didn't. And then the opportunity just, you know, passed them by. So the Kodaks and the others, you know, oh, you should have, you know, owned digital cameras, but you didn't. And so the idea of evolving and not being afraid to evolve and change and adapt is always sort of a piece that's close to me and near and dear. Like, oh yeah, just, you know, don't be that company that just thinks that the world is going to be this way forever. And I think that's such a, you know, as I've been digging into the sustainability space, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I mean, of course, there's many different dimensions of sustainability, the environmental, social governance, and so on. But let's say from an organization standpoint, building a business that survives and thrives, that's one of the things that's really important. So you talked about thinking for the long term and how thinking long term versus short term can lead to really significant outsized results. Can you expand a little bit on that? Because, you know, you have many organizations, okay, you know, we went through a pandemic and, you know, sometimes you have things that lead you to think about what's right in front of your face, immediate survival. So how do you see organizations best reconciling long-term versus short-term to gain the sort of results and rewards that you're talking about?
A couple things I want to touch on before you get into that. So I love that you talked about the companies and stories that scared you, because I love those. But I think there's an important distinction in those. Take Kodak, for example. Kodak had actually invented the technology and it sat there and the company died. Versus Blockbuster, who looked at Netflix and laughed them out of the room when Netflix came and said, hey, we need you guys to buy us because we don't have enough runway. And now Netflix is just like a behemoth of a company, right? And I think those are two very different actions. One is sitting on technology.
Yes.
In hindsight, 2020.
Yeah.
Sounds insane.
Right.
And then the other is being so arrogant that you're like, we own this. We don't need to be in any market. So let's use Blockbuster as an example. If Blockbuster had said, okay, 20 years from now, will people still be walking to the corner
right.
to pick up a video?
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances of that? Anybody who was looking at technology at that time was like, that business model is likely to change.
Sure.
Right? But at the time, their biggest revenue source was late fees. So nobody wanted to be the person to cut late fees.
Yeah.
In fact, they cut late fees for a little bit, and then they changed CEO and he brought back late fees. I think that's how that story goes. So in answering the question of thinking along the timeline, mm-hmm. you have to extend what I call the spotlight, and you have to extend the shadow. So the spotlight is things work out tremendously well. What does that look like 10 years from now,
right.
et cetera. So you look at the spotlight. Then you have to look at the shadow. This decision we're going to make today, how does that impact our company 10 years from now? So there's that kind of piece around it. Then there's a piece around, let's use your company as an example. You're an education company. You're looking at what are the moves we're going to make today that we think we'll win in 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
And usually what you're going to do is you're going to pick two or three keystone events
yeah.
that we're going to bet the company on.
That's right.
And then you go from there. The challenge is what happens is most people look at, okay, this year we want to grow by 10%. What's our plan to do that? Cut expenses, do this, do this, do this. That's not a strategy. That's a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that plan is just about some kind of revenue minus expenses formula.
Yes, yes.
Not necessarily a strategy, whereas Netflix, for example, okay, we're going to eliminate late fees. You can have all the CDs you want. The strategy is no late fees. You know, we're going to move from you having to give this physical CD, we're going to do streaming. That completely transformed the company.
Yeah.
And today, they're in production. They're producing films. Mm-hmm. You can only get on Netflix,
right.
which makes it, and that's a brilliant strategy because now you have all these other streaming platforms. It makes streaming platforms annoying because you have to have like 10
yes,
subscriptions.
Yes, exactly. A million subscriptions
costs you like $100 a month. It's crazy to get all this stuff. But my point is that they're looking at where they think the puck is skating. And here's the thing. You're looking where you think the puck is skating. There is no guarantee the puck is going to be there.
True.
And that is the hardest part about strategy. The hardest part about strategy is that you should feel like, I am not sure if this is the right move, but given everything I know and all the information I have and where I think the world is going, I think that's where we need to go.
Yeah.
If you are absolutely sure of where you're sitting, you're probably
that's
not
actually,
very strategic.
That's probably a very
you're
dangerous
probably,
place. That's
you're
what,
probably,
that's like the most dangerous
because
place.
Here's the thing. Your competition, somebody else, is likely being strategic while you are sitting around planning.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the tech space, which I think applies to multiple spaces, but it's sort of one of the areas where this has become popularized, one of the ways that you can address that, and I sort of say to the team, is, okay, you drop the plan on the sidelines and then you go play the game. And in the game, you have to be able to adapt and react to what's happening. So, I thought we were going to have success going down the right wing. We're not having success going down the right wing. We need to be able to adapt and do something different. What is the role of sort of adaptation, even in service of a longer North Star objective? How do you see the best companies do that?
Remember, it's a compass, right? And you're much better off having a plan. This is the compass, this is where we're heading, and Mike, there's a quote attributed to Mike Tyson. Everybody's got a plan until they get hit, right? And no plan survives real world without the adjustment. It's much better to have a plan for 10 years out than to have no plan and you're consistently adjusting every 5, 10, 15 minutes. So for example, look at COVID is a good example of that. When COVID happened, the first thing we did with our clients was said, When COVID happened, one of the first things we did with our clients is that we said, it's very easy to look at this as a threat. Where are the opportunities for you in this scenario?
Yeah.
The reason we did that with a lot of clients is because we were looking at companies who all they were looking at was their bottom line. Mm-hmm. So they were cutting costs, et cetera, all kinds of things. I can think of two companies in particular. They're competing against each other. One took a cut cost approach, fired people, laid off people, all of that. They had gotten rid of people to save the bottom line. The other company said, we're going to try and keep as many as people as possible. Senior leaders took pay cuts, took delays in pay, et cetera. They did all they could to keep as many people as possible. They took a very different approach because they figured at some point COVID is going to be over.
Yeah.
How are we going to sit after that? When the dust settles, a lot of companies who were in Company B was at cost-cutting approach actually moved away. The best talent from Company B moved to Company A. So now Company A has highly engaged employees, has gotten the best talent from the competitor, and the competitor is now struggling to hire new people.
Right.
It's lost its best talent, and its best talent is now working for its competitor.
Yeah.
Because they played a short game.
That's right.
And there are lots of examples like that where you have to think through, what's the long game here? What's the long play here? So let's take people who are resistant to, let's say, online banking, for example. My question to you is, do you see a world in which online banking is not the future?
Yeah.
The answer to that is no. So you either get on online banking now, or you can keep driving out to the bank as much as you want.
That's right.
You're going to be left behind. And there's lots of examples of that people, you have to think about where is the world going. The traditional pest analysis and SWOT analysis still hold. We have to look at what's happening politically, what's happening economically. Like, it's there. And I think a lot of us, we're caught in the hamster wheel, and we don't take the time to reflect on things, so we end up reacting and not responding.
Yes, yeah.
And leaders really need to take that time to be like, hey, do I understand my business? Do I understand the market? Where are things heading? Because it's not a matter of if you're going to get disrupted, it's a matter of when. Mm-hmm. The average lifespan of very few companies live more than 40 years old, like most companies, done 40 years. Average lifespan of a company is something like 8 years.
Sure.
Right? So your company, if you have a company that's lasted 5 years, congratulations, you did well. Because statistically, it's hard to do.
That's right, 100%. Well, I want to switch tacks a little bit and go backward. You are, a Caribbean person who spans worlds because you operate in North American world, you operate in the Caribbean world. So let's talk about where you started. So where did you grow up, you grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, but where in Trinidad and Tobago? And let's talk a little bit about school. What did you study and, what was some of that path?
I'll try and tell a short version of the story, but I basically grew up in Chaguanas, and for people who don't know where that is or don't live in Trinidad, I grew up in the middle of a cane field, quite literally. They cut out a cane field and put a housing development in there. So we used to go and steal sugar cane, eat it and cut it and all that. It was great stuff. But one of the things that I found that was defining about how I grew up was that there was a soccer field or football field close by. Mm-hmm. And I always found the soccer field was so equalizing. If you had cleats or you had shoes or whatever, no matter what your parents' situation was, how much money your parents had, etc., the best football player is the one who starts and the one who gets the glory. And I loved how that leveled the playing field. The challenge with that for me was that through soccer, through football, I met people from all walks of life.
Yes.
And they became my good friends and stuff. So part of that is I ended up being living in the gray zone of life for a while, where I had guys who were my good friends who were getting into extreme trouble. I never got super deep into it, but I was close to it. And in Trinidad, you end up seeing how inequity could be life or death, and is life or death for some people. Some people are making choices that I didn't have to make. So I didn't make those choices, right? And that, I think that became a really defining thing for me. And it's still defining, because on this trip to Trinidad, two of the guys I grew up with, best friends in high school. One of them was, he sat next to me in primary school. So he sat next to each other in primary school, we sat next to each other in secondary school. He's in a very, very different place than I am today. He is working in a tire shop, struggling to find a job. I would argue in high school, he was smarter than me, more athletic than me, all of those things. But life circumstances have led him to a very different spot. Another friend of mine, he spent some years in prison in the UK for smuggling cocaine, etc. And those are the two guys that I used to run with, right? Those my boys. No longer close to them, for life has just changed like that. And I kept reflecting on, like, why me? Like, it's almost like survivor's guilt.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was just, we had different opportunities, and I really believe that one of the things I'm very passionate about is how do we create more opportunities for more people so that there aren't all these seeds that are going on ground that's not fertile. Because if we have this ground that's fertile, and that way I grew up, I think has informed a lot of what I do, why I work in coaching, why I work in strategy, why I work with people development. I think that piece of how I grew up ended up being very, very important for me. And another piece of how I grew up is my mom ran a communications company, started in our home, eventually got an office. I think it came up to about 13 people in the company at one point.
Right.
Worked for prime ministers, worked for politicians, worked for major energy companies, etc. And there's one experience, there's a woman called Gillian Wall. I'll never forget it. They were doing a camp in Petrichin. Was it Petrichin? But anyway, one of the energy companies. It was called Point Fortin's Finest was the name of the program. And Gillian Wall came in and did a workshop on leadership development and training and stuff. And I remember I sat through that. In those days, I was just like the project manager organizing stuff, right? Mom, hi, I may have to do that. And And I watched that and I was like, that's what I want to do.
Like that, no, that thing. Right.
Whatever she just did there.
Yeah.
I want to do that as a career. When I talked to Gillian, when she told me to talk to this person. And at that point, I hadn't decided to go to secondary school. So that was kind of my first sort of foray into studying psychology and understanding people, studying coaching and all that. Because I've been studying coaching since I started university, because I knew when I met her, I was like, that's what I want to do.
Right.
And then there were two other experiences where I was at YMCA and I did their leadership program and I became a leader. And so that also made me become a facilitator and that kind of thing, that sort of thing. And then understanding, like, I don't know how to frame this, but there are some educational experiences you have that you no longer see the world in the same way.
Right.
And I realized that somebody can teach you a framework or teach you a story or whatever, and all of a sudden, instead of going from this lens, you go to that lens. And the classic example of that in my world is my dad built his dream house, right? And I don't know if you know what foundation bricks are. They're like these big cement bricks that are quite heavy. And he had 300 of them. And he said, move them from here to there. And me and my friend, he was a rugby player, so I played rugby. The first 150 bricks, we moved in an hour.
Right.
Easy.
No big deal.
No big deal.
Right.
Second 150, 3 hours. It was hard, slow, we tired, all that. And I went to my dad and said, Dad, you have two options in life, right? You know, in school where they do those math questions, if it takes one man X time to move Y number of bricks,
yeah, right?
How long will it take two men to move Z number of bricks?
Yeah.
You have a choice. You learn that in school or you learn that in real life. Mm-hmm. Dad, I'm ready to go back to school.
Yeah.
And that's how I went back to school.
That's hilarious. I love that.
No joke, but that's kind of my background of, I had a very, and another piece of trend that I think has really influenced me is, I did primary school, part of my primary school I did in San Fernando, at Point de Pere. So I had South friends in San Fernando. I moved to Capuchin Roman Catholic, which was a very rough government school. So that was a very different experience. My brother and I used to fight every day, no joke. Like, yeah. And we fought because when these two fellas talking, like, all they're talking, why are they talking like that? And because we came from a private school. So we didn't speak Trinidad dialect. So we used to get, my brother was fighting every day. Then I went to school in San Fernando, and I played Harvard's. I did all kinds of things in Port of Spain. So one of the things that I think is unique in how I grew up is I understood San Fernando culture and the nuances that come with that. I understood Chaguanas culture, the nuances that come with that. I understood Port of Spain culture and the nuances that come with that. I never did anything in the East, which is probably why I had so many rivalries in the East with sports and stuff. But yeah. That's probably not true, but I felt that that was important because I understand different aspects of Trinidad in very different ways. Because it's almost like different worlds, right?
Yeah.
And I think that skill has transferred into working in Canada, where because I understand all these different cultures in Trinidad, I now have this sort of intuition to understanding different kind of cultures when I go into an organization and you can see, oh, the factory department working, they have a different culture. But the delivery guys, they have this different. I could spot that really easily, and I think that was an accidental piece of just how I grew up. I don't think that was planned, but that's a little bit of how I grew up. And then went to school in Canada after I did the bricks story. To school in Canada because at that point I was just a hustler. I was like making money. I could make money. Went to school in Canada. Decided to do. I went to the University of British Columbia, and they had a leadership program, student development program. So they trained me how to teach kids to be leaders and all of that. So I've been doing this leadership thing since in university. And then one of the things we did with that is we implemented a coaching program, a peer coaching program. So I used to teach people how to be coaches and all that. And then I did a master's in organizational change and development, which is where I got my first ever academic award.
And then you went from there.
I went down from there. So, you know, so that's how it and that's a short version of the story, but I have a non-linear career.
What I enjoyed about that is you talked about, I think for all people, when you kind of look back, you have these moments that kind of shaped you, right?
Yeah.
I think we probably both believe that you're also continually evolving as a person anyway, but there are some things that, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I was going down here and little tweak. And sometimes it's a little tweak and sometimes it's a big left turn, right turn. But you can really get something from the steps. And I think one of the things you were telling me, offline that was amusing is that you had this passion for coaching and teaching. You went, you did a PhD, you really wanted to teach, you know, in that mood, but here you ended up doing it or finding a different way to coach and do it, which is also funny because I think it's what happens to a lot of us in life too, right? So how did that, you know, kind of, how did that left turn happen?
I hope my wife forgives me for this. The real story of how that happened was I do my PhD. I wanted to become a professor. I wanted to spend my life teaching young people how to think, how to do whatever. That's what I thought I would do. And I have like courses that I have developed that may never see the light of day, but whatever. When I finished my PhD, after you do a PhD, you have to do a postdoc. You have to do a postdoc for a bit and then you can become a professor.
Right.
And in that time. So I went to this postdoc position I got, and they offered me $35,000 a year to supervise 5 students while we were going to be studying precarious work, which was the irony of it. And I came back, and first of all, when I went to that job, I thought I was going to a part-time job because I'm living in Toronto at this time. There's no way you can survive in Toronto on $35,000 a year. It's just not happening.
Yeah.
And I go and tell my wife this, and she's like, look, before you take that job, I'd rather you be a stay-home dad. And I'm like, cool. So I'm not taking this job. Because by the time you pay for daycare and all of that, like I'm basically working to pay for daycare. She's like, you have a degree in education, just stay home and take care of our kids. At this time, we don't have kids when she says this. I'm like, cool. Then I go out and I say, you know what? I want to go and I still apply for postdocs and I start to go out and to do the entrepreneurial thing. My first contract is a $30,000 contract for 3 months' work.
Okay.
My second contract was $120,000 for 6 months' work. I was like, and that was the end of that.
Yeah,
and that was the
fireball at that point. Like, yeah. No, that's in a different direction.
That's a real story of how I ended up going. And there were some serendipitous things that happened where my first clients came very easily and came through networks and luck. And I wanted, luck is where preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of preparation and an opportunity presented itself. I was the perfect person for it and all of that. So I think sometimes you do things in life that you don't know how they would end up benefiting you. A good example of that is when I finished my PhD. So backtrack a bit. When I was at UBC, UBC was one of the first people or first universities to do a TEDx event.
Right, this is University of British Columbia.
Yeah. And I just loved that format. And the minute I saw it, I'm like, this could transform my country.
Yeah.
Like, I just saw it and was like, this is amazing. Because I had already been into TED.com then. I was watching TED Talks. I was actually teaching a course at University of British Columbia. And I used TED Talks. And then this is early days of TED. This is 2008, 2007 maybe.
Yeah.
And I knew deep down that TEDx could have some kind of impact on the Caribbean and Trinidad. So when I finished my master's, I decided, okay, you're finishing master's, do something that you're likely going to fail at. Given the skills you have right now, given where you're at, do something big, because you don't have kids, you don't have any partners, I was single at the time. Now is the time to take that kind of risk.
Sure.
Do something you're likely going to fail at. And he said, I'll do TEDx.
But wait, I mean, I'll stop you there. Because, you know, that is not something that 99, maybe 0.9, but definitely 99% of people would say as a thing that I'm going to do. I mean, you know, in the Caribbean, one would say that I think that's definitely changing as the generations, new younger generations come up. But we, you know, the office here, very risk-averse culture. We don't like to fail. We're very, you know, risk-averse in some ways. So how are you, Trini, here abroad, coming up with a thought? No, I'm going to do something that I'm likely to fail at. Like, you need to unpack.
Given the skills, the skills of where I'm at.
No, right.
Just pretty simple. I was studying innovation. Like, my master's was organizational change and development. Like, I was studying how we make innovation happen in organizations, companies, etc. How do we work with people, quote-unquote HR structures, all of that.
Sure.
And I really had no idea what I was going to do.
Yeah.
Like, I knew I wasn't staying in England because I left England as fast as I could. Because the seeds of Brexit had already been planted when I was there. And I saw that writing was on the wall for me. I'm out of there. So I came back to Trinidad and I didn't, like, what was I going to do? I worked in my mom's company. I'm like, you got to do something for yourself. And I was like, okay, do something big. What's something big you could do? And I always had this TEDx thing in my head.
Right.
And I was like, make a big leap. Because at that time, I didn't know anything about production. I knew coaching. I didn't know speaker coaching.
Sure.
I had no idea how to organize, like, ticketing from it was just all this stuff that
it was all new.
A lot of it was new.
Yeah.
I could do projects. I knew how to manage projects, which is probably the best strength I had. And I just didn't want to do, I wasn't interested in going to get a job in like BP or TSTT. It wasn't something I was interested in. I was like, you have a year to try something. So go big.
That's great.
And I think it was 5 years later, I would have probably started a tech company at that point. But in those days, Facebook had just come out. Like, this was 2009, 2010.
Sure.
So I was just kind of thinking, okay, what's something that you could do that's big? And I knew that failure was a big part of learning. So for me, the worst thing that would happen is I would fail at this thing and I'd learn a ton.
Learn something, yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, okay, what's the business model for this? I'm like, that is a nonprofit event. He's like, sorry, what? He's what? And then my dad is like the biggest TED fan now. Sure. He goes to like TED, Big TED. He goes to TED events and stuff. He's a convert. But that's how it started. I don't have a rationale for it, but I do tell people, if I had done a marketing assessment and done the whole like feasibility thing and all, I would have never done it.
Yeah.
It just would never happen because it made no sense to do. It was, people didn't know what that was. It just wasn't feasible in the market. But sometimes you do things that are kind of,
yeah,
you know, and
I understand that.
And then, I mean, here's something I learned this year. I didn't know this. I learned this year. Most TEDx events happen once. So there are 18,000 TEDx events around the world. Most of them have happened once. We've had 12 TEDx events here in Trinidad, to be
clear. Yeah.
So we've gone 12 times. We planned to do one and see how that was. And the first event, Mark Raymond was on TED.com. So we were like, we got to do this again. And success just happened after success. And TED came to Trinidad, was like, how are you guys producing such great quality events from an island? Because we were the only island country that was producing high quality talks, high production value, all of that stuff. And that also made me double down on the Caribbean is more than a tourist destination.
Yeah.
We have so much talent. And one of the questions people ask me is like, those speakers you had this year were amazing. How are you topping that next year? I was never worried about that because I just think we have so much talent across the Caribbean that like, I'm not worried about our piece. I'm worried about the funding side of it. Like, how I'm going to get people to, but that ended up taking care of itself. So, Luck is where preparation meets opportunity. And so, I never answer for you why I took the risk, but I did.
Right. No, I love that. I mean, you know, that is how, you know, you came across my radar initially, because I moved back to Trinidad like right around the same time. So I think I was here when you did the first one or the second one or what have you, and, you know, kind of seen it grow and evolve, and it really was an amazing thing. And I like what you said about, you know, I didn't know that was the background of it, like intentionally willing to take a risk. But it's true. Like sometimes in life, doing something where you just take a risk and you don't know what you don't know and you haven't thought it through perfectly. Because as you said, you know, if you thought it through all the way, you probably wouldn't do it. So sometimes just that like irrational, I'm just going to go try, take a swing and go, can lead to amazing and beautiful things. And so I love that part of the story. I want to come back to, you know, you said like you were in Vancouver, you're like, oh, you know what? This could have impact. Why, you know, you spend time in Canada, you spend time in Trinidad. Why is that important? Why does that matter to you
having
as an individual, having impact? Like what, we talked about it offline, but tell me a little bit about that.
I don't know where my patriotism comes from, but it's strong. Like I have a big gaze. I'm in Toronto, but I have a big gaze looking back. I probably read more news than most people. I'm probably more on top of the politics than most people because I'm just like, I see so much potential for the Caribbean. I used to be, there's so much potential for Trinidad. I've now expanded that. There is so much potential for the Caribbean.
Yeah, that's the right way. Yeah.
That it's disappointing to me that when I come back and I see basic things not working, I'm like, this is an easy fix. And there are kind of two ways to take this, right? So there are people who say, we've inherited a colonial system and it was designed for us to fail, and that is true. And then there are people who talk about, well, there's so much corruption and we'll never get things, and that's the way things are, and there's some truth to that. But I don't care. Mm-hmm. It's fixable. Let's figure out a way to fix it and solve it. Because when I come to Trinidad, I go anywhere in the Caribbean, I go to Barbados, I go to Jamaica, there's a beautiful thing that I can't describe in the culture of this place, of this region. Like my brother, a freediver, and you know what he says to me always? I live where you vacation. Right? There's something beautiful about it. If we could make this place similar to like a New York in terms of, not New York, like a Canada maybe, a Switzerland or Finland, because things are not necessarily working in the US, I know. But if we could make it in a place where things are working, basic things like you go to telephone company and you want to pay a bill, the system is not down. Like, just basic things like that should be working. I don't know where that passion comes from, but I have a real desire to fix these things. It's a strong... I studied change.
Yeah.
My master's was in change management, right? And I'm doing change management every single day. So that probably additionally frustrates me, where I'm doing work in North America that we could be doing here.
Sure.
And largely... the reasons we're not getting it done is because this system is working for a group of people who are working against making those changes happen. So, and it can be simple things like, I don't know if this is true, but let's say you have licensing office or whatever. Some people getting paid on the side to speed up licensing, da da da. They will sabotage stuff for you to digitize that, because that you're taking money out of their pockets.
Yeah.
So they were actively working against it.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard stories of you put computers in the police stations, they accidentally throw T on the keyboard so it doesn't work. Like, you know, there's sabotaging things because the system as it is right now is working for a group of people. Yeah. But it's not working for the population. It's not working for everybody. And I do have a good answer for why I have this drive, but it's there.
Yeah.
It's a monkey I can't shake.
Yeah, I love that.
It's on my back.
Yeah, you know, hey, I understand it, and I feel it. Hey, we have something special in the Caribbean. I always say the same thing, and I mean, I'm really personally as well, like, very passionate about seeing this part of the world, the people, the organizations, be more globally competitive, be more sustainable, be more influential, and you know, yeah, sometimes it's just there, and you just have to live with it. I want to segue. Kind of come back to sustainability. I personally have been on this journey. I don't consider myself, you know, some dyed-in-the-wool sustainability expert, but I am reorienting this phase of my career to areas related to accelerating the sustainability transition. And the more that I have spent time on that, I see that as, again, not a Trinidadian thing, not even a Caribbean thing. It's actually maybe more so a global South thing, right? Africa, Latin America, Caribbean, and beyond. We were joking around earlier on, you know, early in your days at TEDx, you wouldn't have bottled water that was in plastic bottles, and you would do things that were in some way around sustainability. What, you know, because it's so broad, there's environment, social governance, all these things. Different people, sort of different parts resonate with different people. I've heard you talk about inequity a couple of times, so I'm not sure if it's that. What areas are you really passionate about around sustainability in a Caribbean context?
So I might take you on a tangent here. So, and I might take you in a direction you may not be thinking of. So number one, my number one thing, my book is think about it on the long term, right? So there was a period of my life where I did climate modeling. So we used to do models where we built out if CO2 rises this much, if the ocean warms this much, what will happen? Spoiler alert, it's screwed on the most optimistic ones. And this was 10 years ago,
right?
10, 15 years ago.
Right.
And I went to a conference and this woman was talking to me and she said, I don't want to have kids, because I didn't want to have kids at the time. And she said, why do you want to have kids? I'm like, We're in this climate work. Why are we bringing kids into a world that's doomed? And she said, I know you like business and the startup world and venture capital world. She's like, is that correct? She's like, yes. Why do venture capital people invest in a startup? I was like, skin in the game. She's like, you can't be into climate change unless you have skin in the game. And I was like, what do you mean by that? She's like, you need skin in the game. She was like, you need to have kids if you're serious about climate change. And I talk about a slap in the face. Yeah. I was like, whoa. I couldn't argue with that. I just couldn't argue with that. So as the world is running right now, it is not sustainable. Whether you call it climate change or whatever it is not sustainable. The irony of one of the things that's happening is our technological advances are impacting our social infrastructure.
Yes.
So our social resilience is being depleted. So simple things like we have a loneliness epidemic. That's a challenge. Simple things like older folks are isolated and have no community anymore because they're not living in, they're living alone in apartments. And that's actually contributing to poor well-being for them. And there are lots of things like that. Sea levels rising is a piece of that. Us living on oil, piece of that. So there are a bunch of things that we're doing that are not sustainable, just in terms of we cannot sustain it.
Yeah.
There's a definition of sustainability, which has to do with climate change and environmental stuff, etc. But I know, without a doubt, if you look at most countries in the world, what we're doing right now is not sustainable.
Yeah.
It's going to not end well.
Mm-hmm.
It could end in civil wars. It could not even end, but it could result in civil wars. It could result in all those kind of things. And my passion is, how do we have a good life wherever you live? Wherever you live, you should be able to find a good job. You should be able to, like, walk down the street without being worried about being raped or murdered or anything like that. I think that should be true if we are having a society where people are developing. If you want to have a society that is, like, less civilized, then I think that's a piece that I think we have to address with. My passion is on the social side.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is my PhD was on innovation that is social. What I meant by that is organizational change is largely about people.
Mm-hmm.
Team development is largely about people. What my master's thesis was, most development is failing because we're failing at the organizational level. So the organizations are failing to implement. And that was kind of where my master's thesis was arguing. And then my PhD thesis was saying, if we want to get serious about change, we have to look at the social infrastructures. And there are three components to that. The paradigm that you're existing in, and the paradigm has shifted. So an example of that would be COVID. COVID shifted the paradigm about how people work from home,
yeah,
or et cetera. And a paradigm does two things. It sets the rules for the game and then sets boundaries. That's what paradigms do. So the paradigm shifts. The second thing that happens is, the second component of that is resource flow. So resources begin to change direction in the system, whatever system you're talking about. So let's stick with the COVID example. We're now putting more resources in online, et cetera. Like, you got to put more resources in security because people are taking their computers home, et cetera. So it shifts the resources. And then thirdly, it shifts the interactions between you and I. It shifts the actual interactions. Those are the three pillars of what I think, I don't like using the word social change, but change that is social, change that involves how we interact, because social change has been co-opted to mean a specific thing that involves activism and stuff. I'm not talking about that.
Right.
I'm talking about the fact that in today's world, there are kids who are getting depression because they're on social media kind of thing. That is a change in how we interact socially. When I go to Tobago, not everybody says hi. 15, 20 years ago, you go to Tobago, everybody says hi. When you go in an elevator, everybody says hi. Those social changes, those are the changes that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I think if we focus on that, you would see a marked difference across any society. And it has to be about the people first. I think the technology is easy. That's the easy side. We could fix the technology. I can write code to do this. I used to write code.
Right.
We could write code to do all kinds of things. That's easy. The engineering is easy.
Yeah. But the people and the...
But the people and the politics and all of that, that is the hard part. And we're not spending time. First of all, universities and schools are de-investing from social studies. We're focusing on STEM. Which is why there's now a big fight to do STEAM. You're putting arts back into it.
Like,
it's ridiculous. Like, you have, I think it's crazy that you have people who are writing software, software as powerful as Facebook, etc., and they've never taken a sociology class or a philosophy class.
Right.
I think that's insane. That is, like, the Amish talk about, before we bring this technology in, what would be the impact of this technology on our society in 10 years? if they think the impact of that is not with their vision, they don't bring it in. There's nothing like that in our world. And AI is a good example of that.
Another example, for sure. It's
a classic example of that, right?
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's kind of how I that's my lens of the world. It's the work I do. It's why I believe in coaching and I believe in training and I believe that. I want to be clear on one thing. I do not believe that if I teach you this particular thing, it results in behavior change. If I take you to a course, therefore you are changed. I do not believe that.
It's not that simple. Yeah.
It is far from that simple.
Yeah.
I think change, especially human behavior change, takes time, takes exposure. You have to be going at it over and over. And if we're doing it on a large scale, we have to invest in it. And we're not investing. And when I say we, I'm not talking about the Caribbean. I'm just talking about globally.
Right.
Globally. We're not investing in people in the way that we need to be investing in people to produce high-performing teams, to produce, like, companies that are thriving and surviving, etc. If you want a thriving company, the number one thing you need is a speak-up culture. I need to shout out Shed. Shed is a now friend of mine who wrote a book called Speak Up Culture, which is really about psychological safety. We know that people being able to speak up is the number one predictor of performance. Is it safe? Is it worth it for me to speak up? Right? And that's true in organizations, true in society. Like, in Trinidad, we don't talk about certain topics.
Sure.
Because it's not safe and worth it.
Well, I was gonna say that actually is a good segue and a place that as we wrap, because I love to like wrap with a kind of a call to action and a thing that, you know, that the guest has seen that other people could take away a big learning. And you know, one thing that you've talked about, which resonates with me a lot, is, you know, I personally have a bias toward action. And I think that through not just, you know, depending on government, but organizations and the people within organizations can create change. And you can do something. And if you do something and I do something, we all do it, we can have real, real significant impact. So what's a closing thing that a leader of an organization, you know, particularly building on what you said about, you know, creating culture, creating action within your organization. You know, what's a thing that a leader can do now that you would recommend if they want to drive some of the types of change that we're talking about to advance the Caribbean?
Stop and reflect. Not action. We move to action too quickly. We look at problems and we think we know the answer. And often we're solving the wrong problem, asking the wrong question. We need to slow down. The slower we go, the faster we get there. The more we understand the problem, the faster we get there. Having said that, one of the things I have said before is that your tactics should look like your strategy in action. So to me, start with strategy first. What is the strategy here? Where do we want to be 10, 15, 20 years from now? Most people are like, we need to like grow this company by 5-7%.
Sure.
Let's bring in a sales thing to teach people sales. Versus, what is the thing that will make our clients love our product more? So therefore the sale becomes easier. What is it that's missing for the client, the end user, etc.? That's a very different approach. It's longer, it takes more work, etc. But you're more likely to win in that approach rather than. So, and some companies are going for 1% growth annually, you know, and they're doing all this money, all these things, like, and it's 1% growth that they're going for. I'm like, sorry, what? You know, like, can we go into a new market, that kind of thing? Yeah. So, yeah, I think start with strategy would be the answer, and I'm biased to that because I just wrote a book called Strategy to Action. Yeah. But I genuinely believe that, which is why I wrote the book. Because I think you have to start with strategy and then make sure that everything you do is in service of that strategy. So yeah.
Well, that's amazing. Well, I want to thank you for taking some time to, you know, come and, you know, share some of your experience, share some of what you're working on, and give us some of these points. I love that. Stop and reflect and make sure that the actions you're taking are in service of strategy. That's a great place to end. So I appreciate your time. I'm looking forward to seeing all the great things that come out of the book, and, you know, encourage folks to check out Keita's book, From
Strategy to Action.
Thank you.
Awesome. Cheers, man.
Nice one.